Okay, I think we're ready to start. I really appreciate you guys showing up here. It's a different time. It's right before a three-day weekend. It's a gorgeous day out, and yet here you are, and we do appreciate it. Among other things, I have a couple of special guests, Deandra Leslie Pilecki. She is a physicist, condensed matter physicist at, well, she's in the process of moving from Nebraska to University of Texas at Dallas. And she is the author of the newly published The Physics of NASCAR. One of the things she's going to be doing after I get done with the intro is showing you some clips of the TV show that she put together or, along with NASCAR's help, and telling you a little bit about what that was like, because she kind of got thrust, you know, into this major national media spotlight overnight when the book came out, and it's been a little bit of a shock, needless to say. We also have Jerry Roberts, who's the publications director here at UCSB, and he will be conducting some on-camera interviews with Deandra and also with our own Joel Polchinski. So we will be able to tape these sort of 10-minute mock interviews, and then we're going to have some playback and kind of talk a little bit about what works, what doesn't, you know, what's different about TV, what we notice, you know, based on how we would normally talk to someone and how they show up on camera. To kind of get everybody into the mood, I do want to actually show this very funny clip from The Onion, which is kind of a test. First of all, they capture broadcast media perfectly, especially morning shows. And second of all, exactly what you don't want to do as a scientist if you get stuck on one of these shows. So,
MW10.
Gotta go through the ad.
Nothing else. Pure BMW.
Can everybody hear?
Yeah.
Going to hand it over to Deandra right about now, because I think that's a good segue. It's, I mean, just
why?
how not to do that. I mean, the body language, the depression, the, no, my research is not that interesting. And also just, dealing with TV people, because many of them are, in fact, very much like that. So she's going to talk a little bit about the TV experiences that she had, and then Gary will talk a little bit about, to give a couple of tips to set up the interviewing, and then we will do a couple of mock interviews.
Thank you very much, Jennifer. It's nice to be here. All the times I've been here on the UCSC campus, I've been here doing NSF reviews with various centers of one type or another, so it's nice to be here and not actually having a report to write at the end of my visit. As Jennifer mentioned, I started working on this book. There's a woman named Margaret Wertheim, who is a science writer. She wrote a book called Pythagoras' Trousers, and she has an article in the Journal of Cell Biology where she talks about how science reaches out to different audiences. And she talks about the fact that if you look at who the people are that read Scientific American, the New York Times science section, those kinds of outlets, it's mostly upper middle class white males. And the question she asks is, who's talking to the other group of people? Well, that is sort of how this book ended up coming into being. So it's reaching a very different audience, and some of the things that I'm doing may or may not be relevant as you're thinking about communicating your research, but there are some sort of universals. As Jennifer mentioned, I really got thrust into this. I had not expected it to be quite as popular as it was, although she told me it was going to be. I did not believe her. And so I had tons of media requests, and I basically got thrown into it with absolutely zero preparation. I did Good Morning Honolulu, and I swear that is the same guy. And it was the same thing. And you really get quite appreciation when you get to see behind the scenes in an interview, because normally all you see is the front of it. And you don't appreciate all the things that are going on behind. So, for example, in many cases, when you're getting interviewed, if you have a publicist or a PR person, they may have given the person questions in advance to ask. And so the person will just fire off the questions. You'll answer. They won't listen to your answers. They won't understand your answers. They really won't care what you're saying. They're just thinking about what that next question is. And those kinds of interviews are particularly difficult because you get the feeling you're talking to a blank wall. And basically, you are. Then you get the ones who tell you what they're going to ask you, and then they play a trick and they go the other way. Trying to see if they can get you to mess up. Those are also amusing. And then you get the situations. I was supposed to be doing Fox Business News. Now, why I was doing Fox Business News, I honest God cannot tell you, aside from the fact that they have a NASCAR feature every Friday morning. And why did they have a NASCAR feature? I can't tell you that either. All I know is I was scheduled to do it. And 2 minutes before we were supposed to go live, Bear Stearns went under. And so we got canceled. So flexibility is great fun. One of the things to find out, one of the things to do before you get interviewed, is ask people why they are interviewing you. What is your role there? Are you supposed to be an expert? Is this going to be a piece about your research? Is this going to be a piece about overfunded scientists who are wasting money on, yachts and things like that? It's good, I think, to find that out ahead of time, because it helps you figure out what your role is supposed to be. Now, they want to tell you the truth, but you can only tell them.
Do they even answer?
Oh, yes. Yes, very much. You have to understand that most reporters want to get a good story. And anything you can do to help them get that story, they will appreciate. When I do interviews, I will ask people, how long are you going to interview me for? Because if you sit down and you have no idea if it's 4 minutes or 10 minutes, it makes a difference on your answers. And it's perfectly fair to ask them, do you want minute answers or do you want 3 minute answers? Do you want to not be like this if I should keep going? It's perfectly fine to set that up. Very rarely will you run into a reporter who wants you to look bad, or him or herself look back. So if you look at it more as a cooperation, you're going to get a lot further, you're going to be a lot happier with the results. Although, as I'm about to show you, even when you have people who are very well-meaning, it doesn't always turn out really well. it really is a good idea to figure out what the points are you want to make. All of you who have been through a graduate defense know that when you are asked a question that you can't answer, you can turn it into a question that you can't answer. So think about what you want to say and make sure you have those things at the ready. Most universities have PR offices. I had no idea we had a PR office until I started needing help. And then I found out there are these wonderful people who will actually hand you little bullet sheets that say, do not wear clothes with busy patterns on TV. Do not wear black. Do not wear white. Do not wear large, clunky pieces of jewelry, especially if they're metallic. And they'll go through all those things with you. And that is really good for no other reason than you know what's happening. I think one of the scariest things about doing interviews is just not knowing what's about to happen. If you're a little more comfortable, you'll just feel happier about it. Sometimes they ask you to submit talking points, and that's really great because then you can decide what you want to say. You can actually have answers at the ready. And that makes you look a lot more polished than when they're just throwing questions out at you. And the last point I wanted to make before I show you the video, you will always look at what you've done and hate it. You will pick out every last wrong thing. I was holding my head funny, my hair looked bad that day, God, I look old, all those things. Most people will not notice any of that. And the little things that you pick out and think, oh, nobody else is noticing that. So it's always good when you do these things to sort of then view them with a detached, as if it were someone else up there. Now, I also say that's easier said than done. Working with NASCAR is unique. Anyone admit they follow NASCAR? No, usually not. Okay. If all you know about NASCAR is from Days of Thunder, you would be very surprised to walk into a modern shop. Almost all of the staff members, or almost all of the teams, have at least one PhD, and usually a significant number of people with master's degrees and bachelor's degrees in physics, chemistry, math, and engineering. It has become very high tech. Joe Gibbs Racing has a better scanning electron microscope than we have. We had a better year in football than they had, and that's saying a lot given our year in football. They have their own CNC machines. They have three-dimensional printers. The folks who are working on engines and aerodynamics are using computational fluid dynamics, and they're developing codes that would be publishable were it not for the fact that they're trying to hide what they're doing from the other teams. So it's incredibly large. There's an incredibly large amount of math, science, and engineering in NASCAR that people just really aren't aware of. And you know, the more I got into it, if I'd been able to answer the questions I had about NASCAR in 2 seconds, I wouldn't have ended up writing a book. But I made a lot of neat friends through this. Most of the PhDs got into it by accident, which somehow is appropriate, right? But they're great people, they're doing really neat things, and the fact is you cannot win a race unless you understand math, science, and engineering, and you can apply it. Therefore, there's a natural synergy. And the best part is the fans want to understand why their driver is or is not winning a race, and they follow it. So you can actually listen into the changes they make on the car during a race. And they want to know, why are they changing tire pressure? Why are they raising or lowering the back of the car? Why are they changing the springs? The answer to all that is physics. We recently had an issue, and I say issue because we're not supposed to say cheating. It's cheating. Where one of the person who won the race, there's an oil tank. The oil tank is actually behind the seat. You don't want the oil in the engine because it sloshes around, causes friction with the moving parts, and slows you down. So the oil is in a dry sump behind the seat. It's surrounded by an oil can box, they call it, which is a box that's about, if you look at the top, it's about the size of a good-sized floor tile, and it looks like a house. So it's an irregularly shaped piece of 24-gauge sheet metal. It's supposed to be tightly sealed, because it goes out to the bottom of the car. And as you know, you have forces pushing down on the car, which give you better grip, and you have forces pushing up on the car, which decrease grip. Well, if you come up from underneath on the oil box, if that oil box lid is not on securely, well, there's a way for the air to get out. And so you decrease the lift, increase the downforce, and made your car a lot faster. In order to understand why that was such a significant cheat, you have to understand the concept of net force. So following in Jennifer's footsteps, I have a blog, stockcarscience.com, and I put up a blog about why that was a significant cheat. And I had, as of last time I looked, just about 22,000 hits on that blog. And some really intelligent comments. A few not so intelligent comments, but mostly really intelligent comments. So it's a group of people who really do want to know some math, science, and engineering. And if this is a gateway to get them in and ask those questions and think, gosh, maybe I'll take a physics course, because this sounds like some neat stuff. It's a way to pique people's interest. So once I got involved in this, we have a running joke at Nebraska. My colleague Ted Jorgensen had written a book a number of years ago called The Physics of Golf. My colleague Tim Gay wrote a book about 5 years ago called The Physics of Football. We are not joking about which of the assistant professors is going to be writing the physics of professional wrestling, because we don't know how much further down we're going to be able to go on the food chain. But when Tim was doing the physics of football, there was a man at NASCAR, at NFL Films, who had him write some short 2-3 minute physics of football blurbs that they showed at the stadium. And then they took to Europe and showed them there and tried to get the Europeans interested in football. That person now works for NASA Images. And so he is a guy who really likes science. He knows very little science. He thinks he knows a lot more science than he actually knows. But he wants to communicate the science to the fans. And so we found out on January 20th that we had gotten some money from Voom Networks. Voom is an HD channel. I don't know who watches it. I don't get it. I don't know anyone who does get it. But they were giving us money. It's like at the end of the year when your NSF program monitor says, we have some extra money. Can you justify it? And you go, sure. You think of something. So we had 3 weeks to put together a television program. And the idea was that NASA has introduced a brand new car this year for the purposes of safety and competition. We wanted to talk about the science of the car. And what he wanted to pitch this was me doing research for the book. Now, of course, the book was already, well, was at that time about to be out. But that's what they did. So I'm going to show you a few clips. And I would have to say, they are rather embarrassing. Because everything that I'm looking at there, I'm just going like this. But let me just show you a few of them. We'll see how this goes.
NASCAR. When Deandra Leslie Pilecki was researching her book, The Physics of NASCAR.
Now, the worst part about doing this shot was that I spent 20 minutes going back and forth and back and forth.
Until they got the shot.
The second worst part of it is that the driver that I followed, I was embedded with race team for 3 races. The driver that I followed thought it was really funny as he was coming back to the garage to see how close he could get to me as he was trying to make me jump. I wanted to use one of those because you can clearly see the number of the car. I didn't want to use those. I thought that was good.
She soon found out that the face of the sport is changing. NASCAR got its start in grimy garages filled with guys who got their education under a car. To succeed in NASCAR today, you have to be an engineer or a rocket scientist, like Eric Warren of Michael Waltrip Racing.
In my own defense, this was Las Vegas on the 27th of January. Morning practice was canceled because we had torrential rain and 40-mile-an-hour winds. By afternoon, the winds had gotten down to about 35 miles an hour, no rain, and we were out there. Of course, my hair looked really good before we started this. Technical director there. One of the things I would notice is I have no idea what to do with my hands. I mean, I got no help on this kind of stuff. So if you're going to do something like this, it's a good idea. Talk to somebody who's done some television and get some ideas. The other thing I noticed is that I can nod my head a lot like this. I was sort of like a bobbing doll. This was a great thing to try to record because this was during lunchtime. And the guys who were working on the car thought it was really funny every time we got close to the end of the tape to start the car up. So we have to keep doing it over and over and over.
So what should you be doing with your hands then?
That's a good question.
I can talk about that.
Okay, you can talk about that.
Put them way in front of your face.
I know the one thing they would not let me wear my sunglasses when I was outside. That was one of the things.
What is computational fluid? That's aero, is it? Short for aerodynamics. And aero means air, and literally dynamics means motion. So aerodynamics is the study of the motion of air. And in NASCAR, what we care about is how air moves over the car.
Best way I can explain aero to anybody who knows nothing about it, if you're going down the road at 60 miles an hour, stick your hand out, it's the pressure of the air on the car.
That's a really good example of trying to make that translation from what we understand in terms of physics to what the fans and the crew chief, and I love the nicknames, like Fat Back and Swing. I actually met a guy named Fish. Nobody knows his real name. His nickname is Fish. But it's an example of how we're trying to make that translation. Now, I had my way, he would have come right back after what you said and shown a graphic or made a comment on it. We didn't have time to do that because we were in such a rush to get this done. From start to finish, it was 3 weeks to do the entire production. That's really pretty fast. And then I want to look at one other thing. And then I will let the next speaker speak. We didn't think to do this. I didn't realize I had this with me until we were in the car on the way up here. So I'm somewhat less than prepared.
Pressure exerts different.
There's a lot of features that make the new car a lot safer. The old car was really pretty good about front and rear end crashes, and they had designed the car so that it would collapse strategically.
Holy cow,
he's fine.
But what was really concerning was what happens if a driver gets T-boned in the driver's side door. And so they totally redid the doors.
In the new car, the chassis bars that form the driver's side door are now graduated. In a side impact, the graduated door bars will collapse sequentially.
Now, we had a heck of a time with the graphics, because the first time they made that, it was a small little arrow like this, and it compressed the entire thing. The second time they made it bigger, it was still an arrow, and it was labeled energy. So you can't label it energy. It's just, that's not right. And I wanted this to say force. That made sense to me. I didn't win that argument. I figure the important thing is not put up something that's really wrong. I really would have rather that said force.
Which softens the impact. There is also a steel plate in the door which prevents
the place to use the arrow.
The door is also filled with an innovative new foam which is designed to better absorb energy in an impact.
And that's actually a really neat materials question that they've got there. And the foam raised some other questions. And this was an opportunity we had to really talk about some real materials issues, which is
an outside force can easily push air out of an open cell foam.
Now here again, first time they did it, that energy coming in. And he insists on putting energy here because I made the comment, innocently enough, the difference between open cell foam and closed cell is that an open cell foam squishes. And so it stores energy. It's like a spring. So the reason I said it stores energy, the energy has to go in there to show it's stored. The problem is you're going to see is what do you do with it when you do the closed cell foam?
So the foam compresses and temporarily stores the incoming energy.
And so far.
When the force is removed, the open cells recapture the air, and the foam bounces back.
Now that's the closed cell foam. One of the things you'll notice is it doesn't have very many pores. The real selling point for the impact foam is I can take a piece of it that is as wide as this lectern and as deep, and it's about 3 pounds, because it's mostly pores. So that's not really a very realistic representation.
In closed cell foam, the cells aren't connected to each other, so they can't release air unless they're broken. Collapsing the closed cells dissipates energy.
It dissipates energy, but there it is in the foam. You'll notice it just sort of mysteriously disappears later.
The foam doesn't bounce back. It stays contracted.
So we got the macro idea. The idea that the difference between an open cell foam and a closed cell foam has to do with whether or not it's squishy or it's hard. And in fact, in an earlier part, I actually had a piece of foam and banged on it. Because most of the people watching think that the foam is soft. It's like putting a pillow in the door. And that's, of course, not going to save you from anything. So one of the important things that you want to think about when you're going to do something for the media is, what is my purpose in being there? What message do I want to communicate? It may be a message about your research. It may be a message about the university. It may be a message about your funding agency. But you need to know what it is. Now, with this, our message was we want to have the money to make something that we can then go and sell to Discovery Channel and show them that we can do this kind of a project so we can do something that we have a little more time and we take a little more care with. So, again, you have to fight the big battles. Don't sweat the little ones, because by and large, you're going to put out a lot of effort. You're not going to win those. But the big battles are worth fighting. So I think with that, I will turn it over to you and let you tell me what I should have done.
What do you do with your hands?
Can everybody hear?
Oh, they're taking it, so if you can actually use that, that would be helpful. The people who weren't able to make it, they can do your points.
Thank you all for coming on a long weekend afternoon. I spent most of my career as a print journalist working in newspapers, and in about 1991, I was invited to be on a public TV show about politics and policy in San Francisco, and I found that it was much easier talking than it was to write, and so I came to like TV a lot, and it also pays a lot better. You know, most of what I know about TV has just been done, learned from doing it in a variety of different wonderful ways. So I thought what I would do is really build on what Deandra was talking about, and she really covered some excellent points, and just give some practical tips. And if anybody has any questions along the way, please feel free to ask. I think the most important thing Deandra said was, what is my purpose? Why am I here? What, you know, first of all, what kind of show is it? I think typically, you know, it'll be some interview show where maybe you have 3 minutes to make some point. Possibly if it's a PBS thing, you might actually get to talk about something in depth at some length. But the two things, what is my message? What is it I really want to get out? And prepare that clearly, but don't over-prepare. You know, I've seen people be on TV and they just write lines and lines and lines of stuff. You know, I'm going to say this and that. You don't have time and you're not going to remember it anyway. So, you know, what's the central point you want to make? And what's a clear way of doing that? And what is the context? What is the kind of show that you're going to be on to do that? So you're there to tell your story. It's a very strange world of television. It's filled with annoying, self-important people. And it can get really distracting when you're there because you just kind of, you know, lose your patience with them all. But don't get caught up in all that. Just keep in mind, you know, why am I here? What is this good for me? The other thing, and it's very obvious, this is a visual medium. It's very, very different than print. So, unfortunately, how you look is as important as what you say, if not more so. You know, there's a famous story in politics where Leslie Stahl from CBS News in 1984, when President Reagan was running for re-election, did this very hard-hitting piece about how Reagan had talked about how he helped poor people and old people and schools and so on, but in fact had systematically made cuts through a lot of these programs. And she did this long piece, it was 6 or 7 minutes, which was long for network TV, and put it on. And as soon as it was over, Michael Deaver, the president's set manager, called, and she was sure he was going to be furious. He said, "That was great. We love that piece." And she said, "What are you talking about?" I said, "Well, you had them in all these places with old people and kids and everything. So it was all about the pictures, you know, and that's all that they cared about." And that was the takeaway for a lot of people, and it is the takeaway for a lot of people about what you look like. So, you know, your use of hands is an important thing because, you know, I talk with my hands a lot, and when I first started being on TV, it was very distracting because I would do this a lot. So if you're sitting, which is typically what you're going to do, you know, just keep your hands in your lap, or you can kind of do one of these things, and you can also sort of lean forward in the chair toward the interviewer, which is a good way of kind of establishing a connection with them. You know, if you're standing, you put your hands behind your back. Don't hold a pen. You know, try not to hold anything because it's very distracting for people, and that's what they tend to focus on. So if you are going to gesticulate with your hands, just be sure you keep them down out of your face so that you're not throwing people off on that. Your body language is very important. This guy in the onion thing, I mean, what a schlump. I mean, but you see people like this, like glowering, you know. It's like, you know, you should try to smile a little bit at least. Don't look severely depressed. And don't slouch. That's another thing. You know, you really got to sit upright and look nice because, you know, you don't think about how you're coming across. But, you know, I almost never watch myself when I've been on TV. I can't stand it exactly like Deandra. But, you know, when I did it at the beginning, those were the kinds of things that I was typically doing because I tend to slouch a lot. But just try to keep that in mind. You know, pull your socks up. That's another thing. I mean, it sounds silly, but there's nothing worse than watching TV and some guy's got this, you know, white calf thing hanging out. I'm just like, oh, geez, you know, I don't want to listen to anything he said. And it's all distractions that takes away from what you're doing. Blue shirts are good. Patterns are bad. White is bad. That kind of thing. If you're wearing a tie, check your knot before you go on, because it's also very distracting. I'm like, what is that guy doing with his knot, you know? Always ask where you're supposed to look, because there's multiple cameras around. And, you know, typically in an interview setting, you'll look at one camera when you're introduced. They'll say, you know, today we have Professor Flywheel is here to talk about whatever. And you kind of, you know, give a little nod to the camera. And after that, you know, you either should look in a camera or you shouldn't, but you need to know that. Typically what they'll want you to do is just look at the interviewer and just make eye contact with him or her. But be sure you ask that question. So, because otherwise, you know, you're going to be on looking like this, and it sets a bad tone right from the start that you look lost. You know, Deandra is correct that there are a lot of airheads on television, but do try to make a connection with the person who's interviewing you, and, you know, when you're talking directly to them, make eye contact. Use their name. Always ask their name, which it makes it sound much more comfortable and informal. And the thing you want to avoid is having the viewer at home feel tense and awkward, because what's going on the screen is tense and awkward. So the more you can help relax that interaction, the better off you are. And it also just sounds good to say, well, as you know, Bob, you know, and it's like, yeah, well, you're right, yeah.
I do know a thing or two about string theory, but you know, that kind of jollies them along and it relaxes them. So always use their name at least once or twice in the conversation.
Keep it very conversational. You know, you're not lecturing. Think about you're telling your spouse, you're telling your kids about this. Remember that you're talking not only on the television, but to the audience of people who probably didn't do well in science. Okay? Most people didn't do well in science, and they're kind of threatened by science and stuff. So you want to make it as accessible and as open as you can. Always say thanks for having me. They'll say, well, thanks for being with me. Say thanks for having me. I hate it when people go, you're welcome, you know, like you did them a big favor or something like that. You know, just be pleasant and polite, and it goes a long way to people being able to hear what you're saying. And all these things I'm talking about are distractions that prevent people from hearing those things. So that's what they're about. Again, be prepared, but don't be over-prepared. What's the basic idea? You know, possibly two ideas in 3 or 4 minutes you might be able to get out, but not much more than that. So don't try to put too much information in there. You know, somebody counted once, and on the typical network half-hour newscast, there are, if you took all the words in the newscast, it fills 3/4 of the front page of the New York Times on any given day. So, you know, more words is not necessarily better. It's kind of choosing your words better and putting them together in a way that's plain and clear and accessible. Skim the cream on your work. Give them the headline. Don't kind of get bogged down in the process. You know, well, we really began this with, you know, 800 subjects. You know, tell them what you learned. Tell them what the headline is. And use just, you know, nouns and verbs to do that, and try to demystify the language as much as you can, rather than being too descriptive about things. Do ask what the first question is going to be, and typically they will tell you the truth. You know, where do you want to go with this? How much time do we have? You know, just get anything that's making you feel uncomfortable. Get your answers before. If you want some water, ask for a glass of water. That's fine. And it's always a good idea to have a sip of water before you start. Time goes very fast on television. It just goes like that. And you say, oh, gee, that went much faster than I thought. You always do that. And anything over 30 seconds is a long answer on TV. So keep that in mind, too. And try to keep your answers to 30 or 60 seconds. And you can always go back and break it off, you know, particularly if you're speaking in complete sentences. And, well, let me just add to that point that I had, you know, Bob. Again, you know, if you're on Charlie Rose or something like that, which is a very conversational, more substantive show, that doesn't go. But, you know, our morning show guy here, which is, you know, I think typically what people get on TV, that's the way that goes. Front load the information. Again, don't get bogged down in detail. And, you know, this phrase, as you know, is a good phrase to use, because he doesn't know. But you're giving important information that they need for context to understand what you're saying, but you're doing it, again, in an accessible way. You know, as you know, Bob, in science, we try to stick to the data. You know, Bob's going to say, well, doesn't this mean we can, you know, travel through space soon? And, you know, well, yeah. Which is another thing, because everybody's going to ask you, you know, what is the applicability? What's the practice? Well, what does this mean we're going to have for new kitchen gadgets in 10 years or stuff like that? You know, so just be aware that question is going to come up. And if it is, you know, very theoretical or something, you know, kind of go with the wonder of science argument. Well, you know, it's amazing that there's, you know, this infinite number of pustules that, you know, recreate whatever it is you're doing. But that question is going to come. So know that because, you know, reporters are very literal. And they want to, well, how does this affect me? What am I going to do with this? So just be prepared for that. And let's see. A couple things Deandra said I just want to emphasize. Oh, she said get the macro. That's what I mean by, you know, what's the headline? Skim the cream. What's the big picture here? What's the most important thing that we need to connect with? So that's, you know, just some practical tips. Yes, Sarah.
One of the things I've noticed sometimes when particularly hard, perhaps, for scientists is they're asked questions that require a very generalized answer, and hesitations start to look like they don't know. The hesitation about, I don't want to say something that general, actually looks like a hesitation for other reasons.
Give me an example.
If somebody says something, well, does this mean we can time travel? You know, is a quantum computer really right around the corner? Are we, you know, is this what we should be looking for? You know, the public wants to have some say, sure, you know, go out and found a company right next week. And scientists are not going to say that. But they also don't want to give the, you know, the 10-page answer.
Right.
So I would guess you're trying to say anticipate questions that need a headline for something like that that won't kill the enthusiasm.
Right. And you know, I think if you're asked that question, you could say, well, as you know, one of the wonders of science is that there are any number of applications that can come out of anything. You know, for example, you know, refrigerators and whatever. What was that stuff? They took the orange juice, they took the space, all these great things. Tang, yes. You know, but right now, what we know is this. And that's another good thing to say, you know, what we do know is this. Well, I don't know that, but I do know this. And that's a good way to kind of finesse that question as well.
Any other questions?
I have another one, but I don't.
Go ahead. Go right ahead.
Well, another new kind of show that you see scientists on, like, is the Daily Show, places like that, where the intent is actually for humor rather than a real substantive interview. And how do you prepare if you really want to get a message across? How do you find that balance?
No, that's a very good question. And when I watch a Daily Show, I try to figure that out because authors really have different approaches to them. You know, some try to get in there with Jon Stewart and yuck it up and stuff. And I think it's better just to kind of play it as straight as possible. He's there to make the laugh. You're not necessarily. I mean, if there's something that comes to you, then go ahead and go for it. But I think there's nothing worse than trying too hard to be funny and kind of overreaching for it. And basically, you're there to flog your book. I mean, let's face it. So just make sure he holds the book, okay? Or you can hold the book, whatever. You know, that's what you're getting at.
The Colbert Report in particular prefers you to play straight men.
Yes.
They want the joke to be with Colbert. So every scientist I know that's been on that show, including Neil deGrasse Tyson, he'll joke, he'll wink and that sort of thing, but generally he plays it straight and lets Colbert, and he's just very genial about playing along with the joke, but he plays it straight. That seems to work really, really well. I've had Neil deGrasse Tyson on like umpteen times.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. You know, sometimes if it's like somebody like William Crystal or some obnoxious person, then, you know, then he'll kind of join the banter because Stewart's just pounding on him and insulting him. But I think, you know, typically that they would do that for someone who was there to talk about a book or an idea or something of that category.
How do you handle controversy? When you have colleagues that they've identified a controversy they want to bring up that you just particularly don't want to talk about, it's not that important to bring out on television, how would you...
You mean if the person asks about the controversy?
Yeah. Interviewer, yeah.
Well, I think you could say something like, you know, that's been a question that a lot of people have asked, and, you know, it's certainly something that's, you know, maybe we don't have settled answers on, but what we do know is, you know, and just keep going back to what we do know, and just kind of finesse it. It's just like politics, you know, just answer the question you want to answer. You don't have to answer the question that you're asked.
That's actually going to come up when we interview Joe, I guarantee it. Have a seat. What we're going to do here is just do a couple of short 10-minute interviews. Jerry is the interviewer. We're not going to do an elaborate setup because we just don't have that kind of technology. But we do have this technology. And it's basically going to be talking head because that's all we really have time to do. I'm going to zoom in on you just a bit. And essentially, you will be looking at Jerry. I mean, we're going to be focusing you as if you're having a conversation with Jerry. He pretty much knows what he's going to ask. I'll time it for 10 minutes, and I will give you a signal when you have 2 minutes left.
Okay.
That sound good?
All right. I'm going to try a couple of different approaches that you might see. I'm going to start with kind of the would-be Mike Wallace, which you will see these guys are real hard-ass. They're going to try
And then we'll do a little bit of airhead. And then we can try some Hernandez rows at the end. Okay. Ms. Leslie Kelly, that is in fact the name. Who funded this research?
This research was funded by the National Science Foundation.
So the taxpayers.
Definitely the taxpayers.
Do you think that's a good use of taxpayers' money at a time when we have an AIDS pandemic and lots of problems of homelessness and so on? Are you talking about racing cars?
Oh, well, I think that's a great entree to get into the discussion of fuel and fuel economy and energy efficiency. In fact, if you calculate out how much gas you use in an average NASCAR race, it turns out to be equal to the amount of gas the country uses in 2 seconds.
So you would like to stop racing on behalf of people who are tree huggers? Is that what you're saying?
I think there's a happy medium in there. I think if we all thought a little bit more about how we use our cars, we'd save a lot more gasoline than if, say, we straightened the Daytona 500 and made it to Daytona 500.
Now, you attended these races, correct?
I attended some of the races.
Did you get free tickets?
I was there on a media pass, which I'm sure you've done before also.
Nailed them.
Pretty good. All right, well, let's try the other hand. You know, Deandra, when you think NASCAR, there's two words, Dale Earnhardt. Have you seen his family lately?
I have seen Dale Earnhardt's family lately.
How are they doing?
They're doing really well. It's 5 years after his tragic death at the end of 7 years.
Do you remember where you were?
Where I was. You know, at the time, I was not a NASCAR fan. You know, this is one of the things about the book. If you would have asked me 2 years ago, is NASCAR interesting? I would have looked at you and said, why would anyone want to watch cars going around in circles? But having gotten into it, it turns out there's an awful lot of really interesting math and science in there.
Did you talk to his wife?
I have actually talked to his wife.
How's she doing?
She's doing good. She's very happy. The team is having a real renaissance, as I'm sure you know. Dale Jr. actually left the company. And so Teresa, who is his stepmother, has been trying to get the company back on track. So it's going to be a really interesting year for those folks.
So did the family have kind of a falling out after Dale died? Was that what happened?
Oh, yeah. It's the soap opera that is NASCAR.
Have they read the book?
I don't know. I should ask.
You should ask.
I will be going to a race at Texas Motor Speedway next weekend, and I'll be doing a book signing. While I'm there, I'll be at the Barnes & Noble directly across from the Speedway.
Well, the honors are out of time. I'm really sorry to talk about your book, but please come back.
We didn't ever actually slept with Dale Hart.
It's a morning show. Okay, now we'll sort of do kind of some straight thing. So, tell me what the basic idea of your book is.
Well, the basic idea of my book is that NASCAR is a lot more sophisticated than most people think. It turns out there is a lot of math, science, and engineering behind racing. And I think most importantly is there's a lot of people who really don't realize that they're interested in math, science, and engineering, who are NASCAR fans. And by reading the book, they're going to understand a lot more about the sport and also hopefully get a lot more interested in science.
Well, NASCAR is the most popular sport in America, as I recall. What are some of the scientific applications that are used, and what's the theoretical science that you found behind it, the most important?
You know, I think one of the most important things is aerodynamics, and people have really been studying this intensively. I was really impressed visiting the race shops, the kinds of supercomputer clusters they have in order to do computational fluid dynamics calculations, which is basically a fancy way of saying they're looking at how air flows over a car. So it turns out the amount of grip you have is proportional to how hard you're pushing the tires into the track. And you get a lot of help from the air. And so understanding how the air flows around the car is incredibly important.
You know, I think a lot of people have made the observation that there's a kind of dirty little secret about NASCAR, which is a lot of people are basically watching it to see if there's a crash. I mean, how does the physics piece of this play into the safety aspect?
Yeah, you know, safety is one of the major, as I'm sure you know, safety is one of the major aspects that NASCAR is very concerned about. In fact, they have their own research and development center where they look at safety aspects. I'm suffering from a cold.
Not a place.
I'm sorry, not a real question.
Safety and physics.
So one of the most important things is the idea of conservation of energy. So we all hear about it when we're in high school. And here's an application. So when a car is moving, it has motion energy. Well, if the car's going to slow down, it's got that motion energy has to change into another kind of energy. When you pull to a stop in the pits, it changes to heat or light or sound if you slow the brakes. The problem is if you have to stop suddenly, where does all that motion energy go? And so the idea is you have to dissipate energy anywhere except through the driver. And NASCAR's done a really amazing job of redesigning the new car to make it a whole lot safer for the driver.
You know, I think most people, when they think about the crews on NASCAR cars, they think about the guy changing the tire and so on and so forth, but it sounds as if you're saying that there are scientists who are working on these crews. Is that what you found?
Yeah, you know, it's not just scientists. It's everyone who's on the crew, from the tire changer to the mechanics. They're all using science. They have to understand things like when you change the pressure in the tire, how that's going to change the way the car behaves. Ramon, one of the mechanics on the number 19 car I followed, gave me this really detailed explanation about the wraps they put on the windshield. They actually use plastic on the windshield that they can tear off so that the drivers can see. And he gave me this great explanation about how you cannot have any air in between layers because the air will reflect light and make it harder for the driver to see. So even folks who aren't scientists have to know some science.
Now, you said that 2 years ago you weren't really interested. I don't know if that was in this interview or an earlier one, but I do recall you saying that. So have you spent the time that you have with the cars and with the drivers and with the tracks and looked at the science? Are you now interested in it as a sport? Does it change your view of you know, how interesting it is to watch cars go in circles?
Well, you know, the thing, and I say this in the last chapter of the book, is it really isn't about cars going in circles. It's about the people who are involved. One of the things I really enjoyed was that the people in NASCAR remind me a lot of the people I research with. They're extremely passionate about what they do. They work really hard, and they love their jobs. And when you watch how hard they work, you can't help but want to cheer for them.
Well, Deandra, Leslie, you're obviously very passionate about this. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you came to write this book, how you came to study physics, and let's face it, girls aren't generally good at science, and so that was actually the first
question. That's a really long question. Do you want to narrow it down a bit?
Not really.
Tell us
about your background. How did you get to this point?
How I got to this point? I don't study anything having to do with NASCAR. I'm actually a researcher in nanomedicine. And so what we study is how we can use material science, which is my background, to treat cancer and to do better magnetic resonance imaging. So my interest in NASCAR really doesn't have anything to do with my research, except for the fact that both are trying to pursue science. It's the same thing. We have different goals. We're trying to cure cancer, and they're trying to make their car go faster, but it's the same process.
Talk a little bit about nanoscience, because I know we hear the term a lot, but I think a lot of people are really, just think that it's like making really tiny refrigerators and things like that. What is nanoscience?
Well, you're right. That nano is trying to make things small. If you could take one of your hairs and divide the diameter by 1,000, then one of those would be about a nanometer. And so we're talking about things that are really small. The advantage for having things small when you're talking about medicine is that those structures can actually get into cells and interact with cells. My particular research I've been working on is chemotherapy treatments. And so you may know one of the things that's really problematic about chemotherapy is that it has all kinds of horrible side effects. And so what we're trying to do is attach the chemotherapy drugs to magnetic nanoparticles and then use a magnetic field outside the body to trap the drugs at the tumor, which means the drugs aren't racing around, going and doing things like making your hair fall out, making you nauseous, killing white blood cells.
So are you saying that you're curing cancer?
We are helping cure cancer, yeah.
What stage is that at? Is that clinical trials or is that being used in therapy?
We are actually still in animal testing. One of the things that I learned coming at this as someone who skipped biology as much as I could because I didn't like it in school, now working in medicine, I've really come to appreciate how much rigor there is in the FDA requirements for getting something approved for human use. So we're in an early stage, but the results are really promising.
So do you feel ethically as if this important research that you're doing on cancer has been shortchanged by the amount of time that you've been forced to give to this book. Basically, in bullshit.
Here's another parallel. You know, the driver gets all the glory for winning the race, and in reality, there are 14 or 15 people who put the car together and got it ready to go and made it go fast. It's the same thing in academia. The professor is up in front of the camera having all the fun, and meanwhile, the postdocs and the graduate students are hopefully back in the lab working really hard.
And where are you with this in this food chain?
I'm at the top.
That's good. That's what 2 months of intensive media training on the job.
The thing I didn't mention, the one thing that I've done an early morning interview with Shock Jock out of D.C. So he opened it with, how does a nice girl like you get into NASCAR? And then proceeded to ask me whether I knew if specific drivers were gay. I told him I wasn't that kind of a doctor.
So, Joe, you want to give a shot?
I think going second would be easier, but no, I'm pretty careful.
You might not come back anymore.
No, I picked you in part because I thought you would come on very well on camera, so I don't think you have anything to worry about. But obviously, we've got a different topic here. We've got string theory. It's a little more abstract, and I'm just going to kind of let you run with it. Polchinski is his last name. About all I told him was that you're a string theorist and you invented deep brains.
Yes, so, that's about all I know about the subject. Fascinating interview.
Yeah, well, it'll give you an idea of the level that you're going to have to tailor your answers to. So we are rolling. And go.
Well, Professor, thank you very much for... may I call you Professor?
Oh, Joe.
Joe, very nice. Yeah, thank you for being with us this morning. Now, you're an expert in string theory, is that correct?
Yeah.
And what is that exactly?
Well, it's a search for the basic laws of nature. I mean, we know a lot about nature. We know about the nuclear forces and so on, and quantum mechanics and gravity. And we're looking for how it all fits together, because as we learn more, we seem to find that it's like putting together a puzzle, and the pieces come together, and we're trying to get those last few pieces, well, maybe the last few pieces, maybe there are more we don't know about, trying to get these last few pieces together.
And what is the state of the research now? Where do things stand? I mean, is this generally accepted in physics, or is it still controversial?
Oh, it's really interesting. It's a good question, because there is... we're talking about things that are vastly smaller than experiments can reach today. Just as atoms, when they were first predicted, were much smaller than any experiment could see, and it took a century or more to go from the prediction to actually seeing the atoms, we're in a similar state in string theory today, where by putting together the clues that we have from the things we know, we seem to find that the theory fits together in this way. And the more, it's a work in progress. We don't have a finished form. But as we learn more, it seems to be fitting together better. And there are signs from nature that we've got things right. Some of the most exciting experiments in the last decade, the discovery of the dark energy, and the quark gluon plasma that's been found in particle accelerators, turn out to be understood within string theory. So we have progress both in theory and in the experiments.
And what are the implications of this for, oh, say, me?
Well, so the, you know, the questions, you know, how did the universe begin? What is it made of? What are the laws that make it work? These are the basic questions that mankind is trying to answer since we've been around. And, you know, the feeling that we're getting close, that we're learning, but certainly we've learned a tremendous amount in the last century, both experimentally and theoretically, in the sense of getting close. And, you know, I think that this is what drives me, just wanting to know the answers to these very basic questions.
So basically, these are kind of internal questions that you're seeking to find scientific questions that have been asked by philosophers, that have been asked by religion, but basically you're seeking scientific.
I mean, even something like the beginning of the universe is, you know, there's certainly a large part of the scientific question, if not all of it. And experiments are now reaching back to tiny fractions of a second after the Big Bang, measuring the properties of the ability risk for tremendous precision. There are theories that match these experiments, again, to great accuracy. And so there really is a sense that we have the tools to reach back maybe to the very beginning.
How long has this theory been under examination? How long has this been discussed and researched?
Well, string theory was born approximately 30 years ago. It's gone through a period of different kinds of development. As with many scientific theories, as you know, you discover it in a funny sort of way. You don't usually see the entire theory in one, you know, in one sudden realization. You discover a little piece of it, and then you piece together a bit more. And so we've gone through now in 30 years sort of a steadily deeper understanding of what the theory really is.
How will you know when you're finished?
That's a good question. One answer to that is just in terms of our understanding is now in many ways still based on a number of different approximations. So again, in physics, we have, you know, we often don't have the exact equations. We have approximations to them that get better and better. And we know that our equations are just approximate. We can understand just from the internal logic of the mathematics what's missing and what we need to do. At the same time, we certainly have hopes that you know, upcoming experiments, the Large Hadron Collider particle experiment, or observations of the universe, or gravitational waves, will give us a more definite experimental indication that we're going in the right direction.
Are there physicists who believe, who don't believe string theory, who attempt to debunk it, who feel that it's not a unifying theory at all, and propose that there must be an alternative?
No, absolutely not. Everybody knows that it's correct. This is a really good question. You might be, you know, referring to the controversy, you know, that's going on recently with some books that have been published. Now, I mean, on the one hand, you know, until there is decisive experimental test, no one can say the theory is right. I think a lot of the controversy that's been in the media, though, is trumped up.
By the media?
Now we're eating, yes, yeah. Really, there was one book that was, you know, made a very big impact. It was very well written, but although it was written by a scientist, it's not written the way a scientist writes. It's really basically spin. And it's you know, very, I don't know, it's not something that as a scientist one is used to responding to, but that's been the source of a lot of the controversy.
When, you know, we've seen other scientific, big scientific issues, you know, the genome project, the biological drugs, and so on, where there's been tremendous competition with science, but I understand this is more of a communitarian approach in as far as string theory, where people are constantly posting things on the web and so on.
Well, I think biology is more competitive because more money is involved. But obviously, there's still, you know, there's still a competition to be the first one to, you know, to solve the next problem, to the first one to find the next step that you know will lead the field forward. So, but you're right that communication is very good. We have this web archive, and so results are published very quickly. And it's very clearly, well, as with anything in science, you know, it's a collective activity. I mean, it moves forward because different people, you know, see different directions.
Any predictions on when this will be solved, Joe?
That's a good question.
5 years, 10 years.
It's not the kind of thing one can predict. I have to say that I've been working on this not since the beginning of the subject, for over 20 years, and it's remarkable to look back on how far we've come, on how many questions that 20 years ago seemed really impossible, just couldn't even get a start on them, and we now think we know the answer to them. So it's kind of daunting to try to put a date on when we'll be done. But if you look at the past and look at the progress we've made, it's something we can foresee. That's all I can say.
Well, thank you very much for being here.
Thank you.
You did great, actually. And I noticed that the minute you guys cracked a joke, you loosened right up. I wanted to mention that because I think that we don't realize sometimes that just sometimes cracking a joke at the beginning of an interview, it sets the subject at ease, it sets you at ease, it gets you kind of feeling like you're connecting with your interviewer. And I saw that actually happen. And I think you watch for that when we watch the playback. You will actually see when they finally connect, and you will actually see Joe's body language change. That's just very, very important. Because you're kind of nervous at the beginning, and who wouldn't be? You're getting put on the spot.
It's much easier to do when you don't have your peers around you.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah, that's a good thing.
So
he also didn't have the airhead interview.
Yeah, he didn't get the airhead interview.
Or the Mark Wolfman call it.
But actually, the airhead would have been funny. So strings, they sound pretty.
Yeah. Actually, that was the airhead.
See, and I would have done an actual airhead. So that's probably a mercy that we had you do it. I don't know if you have to leave or not. I know you said about...
I want to just see a little bit of...
I want to see a little bit of playback, but just in case, can we just thank Jerry if he has to walk out the table? It was just nice for me not to have to, do all the interviews. You can kind of see that the way I would have done it would have been different from Jerry. And Jerry was great because he was able to take different personas. And you don't know what you're going to get.
I have a question, Mike. Would it be a good idea for someone in Joe's position to accept an interview on a show where he was going to be interviewed about string theory by an airhead? Or would that be an impossible situation? Is it good for any publicity is good, or what's
next? There's a saying that any publicity is good, and I'm not sure I agree with that, because I think that you will get string theory out there, but chances are you'll just make the person look bad.
Yeah.
But it will be very unpleasant. It would be very unpleasant for Joe, I think.
And the problem is sometimes you just don't know until you get there, because you may not get airhead, you may get ill prepared.
Yeah.
Which can be even worse.
Okay. Yeah. So
we are going to walk. I just think it depends on what you're trying to accomplish. What do you want?
I have a couple of...
Yeah? Okay, here we go.
Yeah, your lighting, by the way, is really bad.
I'm going to start with kind of the would-be Mike Wallace, which you'll see these guys are going hard-ass. They're going to try. And then we'll do a little bit of airhead. And then we can try some Ernest Charlie Rose at the end. Okay.
Okay.
Ms. Lesson Helen, if that is in fact who funded this research?
Well, this research was funded by the National Science Foundation.
So the taxpayers.
Definitely the taxpayers.
Do you think that's a good use of taxpayers' money at a time when we have an AIDS epidemic and lots of problems and homelessness and so on? To be talking about racing cars?
Oh, well, that I think that's a great entree to get into the discussion of fuel and fuel economy and energy efficiency. In fact, if you calculate out how much gas you use in an average NASCAR race, it turns out to be equal to the amount of gas the country uses in 2 seconds.
So you would like to stop racing on behalf of people who are tree huggers? Is that what you're saying?
I think there's a happy medium in there. I think if we all thought a little bit more about how we use our cars, we'd save a lot more gasoline than if, say, we shortened the Daytona 500 and made it the Daytona 500.
Now, you attended these races, correct?
I attended.
You were behind the scenes. And did you get free tickets?
I was there on a media pass, which I'm sure you've done before also.
Whoa. That's pretty good. That's pretty good. All right, let's try the airhead. DeAndre, when you think NASCAR, there's two words, Dale Earnhardt. Have you seen his family lately?
I have seen Dale Earnhardt's family lately.
How are they?
They're doing really well. It's 5 years after his tragic death at the, actually 7 years.
Do you remember where you were?
Where I was, you know, at the time, I was not a NASCAR fan. You know, this is one of the things about the book. If you would have asked me 2 years ago, is NASCAR interesting? I would have looked at you and said, why would anyone want to watch cars going around in circles? But hadn't gotten into it. It turns out there's an awful lot of really interesting math and science in there.
Did you talk to his wife?
I have actually talked to his wife.
How's she doing?
She's doing very well. She's very happy. The team is having a real renaissance, as I'm sure you know. Dale Jr. actually left the company. And so Teresa, who is his stepmother, has been trying to get the company back on track. So it's going to be a really interesting year for those folks.
So did the family have kind of a falling out after Dale died? Was that what happened?
Oh, yeah. It's the soap opera that is NASCAR.
Have they read your book?
I don't know. I should ask.
You should ask.
I will be going to a race at Texas Motor Speedway next weekend, and I'll be doing a book signing while I'm there. I'll be at the Barnes & Noble directly across from the Speedway.
Well, DeAndre, we're out of time. I'm really sorry we didn't have a chance to talk about your book, but please come back.
We didn't ask her. She slept with Dale Hurst.
It's the morning show, okay? It's not entertaining. Okay, now we'll sort of just kind of do a straight thing with sort of Charlie Rose type. So, tell me what the basic idea of your book is.
Well, the basic idea of my book is that NASCAR is a lot more sophisticated than most people think. It turns out there is a lot of math, science, and engineering behind racing. And I think most importantly is there's a lot of people who really don't realize that they're interested in math, science, and engineering, who are NASCAR fans. And by reading the book, they're going to understand a lot more about the sport and also hopefully get a lot more interested in science.
Well, NASCAR is the most popular sport in America, as I recall. What are some of the scientific applications that are used, and what's the theoretical science that you found behind it, the most important things?
You know, I think one of the most important things is aerodynamics, and people have really been studying this intensively. I was really impressed visiting the race shops, the kinds of supercomputer clusters they have in order to do computational fluid dynamics calculations, which is basically a fancy way of saying they're looking at how air flows over a car. So it turns out the amount of grip you have is proportional to how hard you're pushing the tires into the track. And you get a lot of help from the air. And so understanding how the air flows around the car is incredibly important.
You know, I think a lot of people have made the observation that there's a kind of dirty little secret about NASCAR, which is a lot of people are basically watching it to see if there's a crash. I mean, how does the physics piece of this play into the safety aspect?
Yeah, you know, safety is one of the major, as I'm sure you know, safety is one of the major aspects that NASCAR is very concerned about. In fact, they have their own research and development center where they look at safety aspects. Pardon me. I'm suffering from a cold.
Do that.
I'm sorry, not for the question.
Safety. Safety and physics.
Safety and physics. So one of the most important things is...
So I'm going to pause this and open it up for discussion. What did you all notice? Yes.
Maybe this is just because I've gone from a life in physics to doing a PhD in education and doing gender studies. But I noticed, first of all, that you called her Ms. DeAndre Lekekeleke, and you called him Professor Joe Kuchinski.
No, I was goofing on that.
Okay, yeah, but and I thought about that. Is that something I really want to correct? Is that going to make a big difference? I decided to let it go.
Okay. But I've read papers and stuff from the early 1900s, and they talk about Emmy Noether as Pauline Noether instead of Professor. And in the New York Times about a week ago, I read an article about Barack Obama's mother. And in the article, the writer said she wrote an 800-page dissertation in anthropology and Java. Okay, now somebody writes an 800-page dissertation, deserves to be called doctor. They get referred to her as Ms.
That's the New York Times.
That's their style.
But that's so. That's
they do that male or female.
They don't use the honorific doctor for PhD.
But they did later on in that same article about somebody else.
It's probably an MD.
Yeah, they use the doctor. Seriously, this has happened because my husband gets quoted there all the time, and it's always Mr.
And I was just being obnoxious, which is why.
Anything else?
Well,
yes.
I noticed that Jerry immediately decided to stop being obnoxious as soon as she got the better of him.
I went completely blank. I couldn't think of a comment.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, I did, but. But that's me.
I was really
impressed with the way you turned every question either into a positive or into the question that you wanted to answer,
yes,
and very smoothly. So the enthusiasm was absolutely even all the way through. You never sort of went, oh my God, you know, how do I answer that?
Yeah, and she got the plug for her book in.
Yeah. Yeah.
All the reporter wanted to talk about was Dale Earnhardt's
right.
family.
Right.
You know, that was a really nice way to handle it.
Mm-hmm.
So, and of course, I do apologize. I mean, we are dealing with very low budget stuff. We're dealing with bad lighting. You know, we didn't have a makeup person. We had hair and makeup. But that could be the case. I mean, I did a local television spot in Maryland, and I looked great when I left, but it was one of those frizzy days, you know. And by the time I got there, everything was every which way, and my makeup was smudged, and there was just no time to fix it.
And you should take a mirror, even if you're male, take a mirror with you, and before you go on, just check. Make sure that you don't have, you know, one piece of hair hanging down or something in your teeth. It's a good idea.
And personally, I would actually check yourself in the camera. And look at the video, play it in the monitor, and just make sure that, you know, your hair is looking. Because sometimes what you see in the mirror is not what's coming out. The mirror will lie to you, the camera won't. I don't know why that works.
Well, the other thing it lets you know is it lets you know how much of you is in the frame.
Mm-hmm.
Because I think the thing that's distracting is when you have, like, a finger coming into the frame every now and then. So you know you're being shot, shoulders up or waist up. It makes a big difference in knowing that.
Yeah, so I'm going to push forward a little bit because we want to get some of Joe's play back here.
When we're in.
So
when I cock
forward up.
And see, what I noticed was that my head, it cocks like this a lot.
Yeah, actually.
And I raise my eyebrows a lot.
But that's expressiveness. I don't think people necessarily.
I know, but I'm going to get wrinkles here.
Botox fixes all. You'll never have an expression again. It'll be all better.
But that's a typically female thing, too, the tilting the head.
Mm-hmm. And people will make a big, Hillary Clinton has had that problem, right? Looking haggard in bad lighting and things like that. So, I mean, people pay attention to that sort of thing. So, there we go. Here's Joe.
May I call you Professor?
Oh, Joe.
Joe, very nice. Yeah, thank you for being with us this morning. Now, you're an expert in string theory, is that correct?
Yeah.
And what is that?
Well, it's a search for the basic laws of nature. I mean, we know a lot about nature. We know about the nuclear forces and so on, and quantum mechanics and gravity. And we're looking for how it all fits together, because as we learn more, we seem to find that it's like putting together a puzzle, and the pieces come together, and we're trying to get those last few pieces, well, maybe the last few pieces, maybe there are more we don't know about, trying to get these last few pieces together.
And what is the state of the research now? Where do things stand? I mean, is this generally accepted in physics, or is there still controversy?
Oh, it's really interesting. It's a good question, because there is, we're talking about things that are vastly smaller than experiments can reach today. Just as atoms, when they were first predicted, were much smaller than any experiment could see, and it took a century or more to go from the prediction to actually seeing the atoms. We're in a similar state with string theory today, where by putting together the clues that we have from the things we know, we seem to find that the theory fits together in this way. And the more, it's a work in progress. We don't have its finished form. But as we learn more, it seems to be fitting together better. And there are signs from nature that we've got things right. Some of the most exciting experiments in the last decade, the discovery of the dark energy, and the quark gluon plasma that's been found in particle accelerators, turn out to be understood within string theory. So we have progress both in the theory and in the experiments.
And what are the implications of this for, oh, say, me?
Well, so the, you know, the questions, you know, how did the universe begin? What is it made of? What are the laws that make it work? These are the basic questions that mankind is trying to answer since we've been around. And, you know, there's a feeling that we're getting close, that we're learning, but certainly we've learned a tremendous amount in the last century, both experimentally and theoretically, the sense that we're getting close. And, you know, I think this is what drives me, just wanting to know the answers to these very basic questions.
So basically these are kind of eternal questions that you're seeking to find scientific answers, questions that have been asked by philosophers, that have been asked by religions, but basically you're seeking scientific answers.
Yeah, I mean, even something like the beginning of the universe is, you know, there's certainly a large part of a scientific question, if not all of it. And experiments are now reaching back to tiny fractions of a second after the Big Bang, measuring the properties of the early universe with tremendous precision. There are theories that match these experiments, again, to great accuracy. And so there really is a sense that we have the tools to reach back maybe to the very beginning.
How long has this theory been under examination in the field of physics? How long has this been discussed and debated, researched?
Well, string theory was born approximately 30 years ago. It's gone through a period of different kinds of development. As with many scientific theories, as you know, you discover it in a funny sort of way. You don't usually see the entire theory in one, you know, in one sudden realization. You discover a little piece of it, and then you piece together a bit more. And so we've gone through now in 30 years sort of a steadily deeper understanding of what the theory really is.
How will you know when you're finished?
It's a good question. One answer to that is just in terms of our understanding is now in many ways still based on a number of different approximations. So again, in physics, we have, you know, we often don't have the exact equations. We have approximations to them that get better and better. And we know that our equations are just approximate. We can understand just from the internal logic of the mathematics what's missing and what we need to do. At the same time, we certainly have hopes that you know, upcoming experiments, the Large Hadron Collider particle experiment, or observations of the universe, or gravitational waves, will give us some more definite experimental indication that we're going in the right direction.
Are there physicists who believe, who don't believe string theory, who attempt to debunk it, who feel that it's not a unifying theory at all, and propose that there must be an alternative?
No, absolutely not. Everybody knows that it's correct.
I actually knew the answer to that.
This is a really good question. You might be, you know, referring to the controversy, you know, that's gone on recently with some books that have been published. Now, I mean, on the one hand, you know, until there is decisive experimental test, no one can say the theory is right. I think a lot of the controversy that's been in the media, though, is trumped up.
By the media?
Now we're meeting, yes, yeah. Yeah, really. There was one book that was, you know, made a very big impact. It was very well written, but although it was written by a scientist, it's not written by a scientist, right? It's really basically spin. And it's you know, very, I don't know, not something that as a scientist one is used to responding to, but that's been the source of a lot of the controversy.
When, you know, we've seen other scientific, big scientific issues, you know, the genome project, the biological drugs, AIDS, and so on, where there have been tremendous competitions among the science. But I understand that this is more of a communitarian approach in as far as string theory, that people are constantly posting things on the web and so on, and testing their ideas.
Well, I think biology is more competitive because more money is involved. But obviously, there's still, you know, there's still a competition to be the first one to, you know, to solve the next problem, to the first one to find the next step that.
We're kind of running late again, so I want to actually talk a little bit about what's happening there. You can actually see that moment I talked about where they start joking around and suddenly you're leaning back and you're relaxed and your whole face loosens up. And
I wouldn't trust that guy who was talking in the first
place. Well, I just think that you were closed. You were kind of guarded. You were a little nervous about being on camera. And until Jerry kind of figured out how to set you at ease, and you could see him trying as the interviewer, trying to draw you out and feeding you a couple of things. So you had a friendly interviewer, and that helped a lot. You also had a really tough time because you're dealing with something very abstract that people know nothing about, and you know your interview doesn't know anything about it. How do you break it down? The things that I liked was when you kept going back to explaining how theory works, putting the puzzle together. You find a little piece, and then you find another, and then you find another, and then you start putting them together. That, I think, for future appearances, you might want to develop that analogy. It's a really good way to talk about what it is that you do, because we don't know. The average person does not know what a theorist does, other than that you sit around and you think really hard. But I think that that puts it in a perspective that we can really relate to. Do you have anything you want to comment about? Anyone else?
I should notice.
Go ahead.
Well, I was just going to ask a question. Which books are you referring to?
Oh, the book by Smolin I was talking about.
Is there a reason why you didn't mention it by name?
Yes.
He's asking.
Why plug Smolin?
Why plug Smolin? Which is good. And I also thought that you stuck to your message. I mean, you struck, because I know a little bit about the string theory controversy, you made a point of saying, yes, it's a theory, it's not done yet. There are some experimental indications that we're on the right track. You kept coming back to those, and that's why. So you stayed on message in that respect.
I mean, the big difference for me, I mean, I wouldn't be anything like as good as he was, but the big difference was that she maintained eye contact with the interviewer the whole time. I mean, never wavered away from his face. I mean, is that something
you learned? Although I was not necessarily looking at him. I was looking in his direction.
Well, from where we were sitting, it looked back the way it looked, whereas Joe...
Because I was doing the same thing he was. I was listening really carefully with the question, trying to figure out my answer.
But why he's thinking,
that's a very good point. Yeah. It's not what's actually going on. It's how you're coming off on the camera.
It looked better on the camera somehow than it did in real life.
Is that right?
Yes.
It looked like you were making eye contact and were talking to the interviewer, whereas it looked like you were being evasive.
I mean, a lot of people, when they're thinking with certain parts of their brain, their eyes go the other way. It's the way we think.
Yeah, it's the way I think.
And so it really requires training. I mean, I agree, it's terrible. But it requires real consciousness to not do that.
I don't think it was terrible. I think you do come off very well.
Yes, you come off very well.
More importantly, even in this horrible lighting, you're very photogenic. You come off very well on camera. So it's just a matter of being aware of these certain things, which is why we did this exercise. And it's certainly something that I would recommend, that if you are having a TV appearance, you have the resources here at CITP. Talk to Sarah, talk to the AV people, and have some run-throughs if you know you're going to be on TV. Because this is so helpful.
Yes. I think that really, in Joe's defense, until you know where the interviewer is coming from, when you know that controversy is in the background, and he really was very well prepared.
Yeah, he did a good job.
He knows the situation very well. But until that comes up, it isn't just that that became the joke situation. It's a big question as to even who it is you're facing, and where they're coming from, and which of the two books they may have read, and which newspaper articles about it they may be actually blogging or trying to pursue. Because they're from the media, they're most likely in that ambit, at best, the scientist journalist.
Right, and that goes back to what DeAndre was saying at the beginning, which is, when you know you're going to be interviewed on TV, do try and do your due diligence and do a little homework beforehand. Try and get a sense. You won't always, but it's a good idea. And I think that Joe knew well enough that question was going to come up.
Yeah, and I thought he was very balanced. And
there's no way that question at this point is not going to come up.
But he may have come up, it came up defensively, because he was. He's waiting. And he's giving good answers for no matter what the rest of it. That I think, is a positive thing.
So what did you think? Did you find it was helpful? Or?
Yeah, it was fun. I now know why my heart was cut out of like a universe. They wanted somebody who was looking at his lap all the time. You know, they interviewed me for like 3 hours
and you 15, got zero?
15 seconds. The worst possible 15 seconds.
Yeah, that invariably happens, actually. But it's always like that one thing you make.
That goes exactly back to what Jerry said, which is, because it is so visual, they will pick something that looks good over something that has content. And if you want to get your message out, it's worth worrying about how you come off. Because otherwise you will end up on the cutting floor, even if your content didn't deserve it.
Right, because your content was very substantive, I thought, and very thoughtful and well-prepared. But
you know, it's just a matter of, you know, working on the eye contact, or at least the illusion of eye contact, which, you know, is what Deandra created, even though she was doing exactly what you were doing, which is kind of not really looking at him and really listening to the question and exploring for answers, but she made it look like she was looking at him.
If you had asked me where I was looking, I would have said I was looking at the interviewer. I had no idea that I was doing that. Yeah.
But the level, but when you did meet his eyes, the level of interest goes up by about 1,000% in what you're saying. And it really has an impact on how people are perceiving or hearing what you're saying.
Yeah. So if I were going to give you advice on your next TV thing, I would say watch the eye contact. And try and do something at the very beginning of the interview to loosen yourself up. You know, chat with the interviewer a little bit beforehand, maybe do a little bit of pre-chat. A really professional interviewer will do that with you, particularly if it's a friendly kind of thing. Because, you know, I think that you're a little bit like me. You know, I tend to be a little nervous when I start, and the more I get into it, the more I forget that the camera's there and I relax. And invariably, the last 10 minutes is better than the first 10 minutes for me. I suspect you're the same way, so that would be my advice the next time you do that. So, but other than that, I thought you guys did great, and I know that it was asking a lot of you to put you on the spot, so I appreciate it greatly, because I think that this made it so much more helpful to be able to do something like this, that I was a little bit more interactive. And I guess that's it. I mean, we're a little over, but thank you very much.